The Tudors Dynasty Podcast.
Hello and welcome back to the Tudors Dynasty Podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Larson, and I am joined once again today by my great friend, Dr. Emma Cahill Morone. Emma, welcome back.
Hi, Rebecca. How are you? You must be sick of having me on the show.
I feel like I need to have like a special introduction song where I sing your name or something and make it like this whole thing.
Well, you know, be my guest. I like the idea, the sound of it.
Well, you know, you are just a wealth of knowledge when it comes to the Spanish monarchy. And the responses that we've been getting from previous episodes together on this topic have been amazing. And people, the listeners are really enjoying this topic. And so I invited you back again today to kind of maybe fill in some blanks, maybe is the best way to describe it.
Yeah, you're right. Well, first of all, thank you for all those lovely comments. I might take the stage name Dr. Emma. I like that. So, you know, stay tuned, maybe. And it's just, you know, it's so easy to talk to you, Rebecca. And I feel like we complement each other very well because there's so much I don't know about the Tudor court, especially since my first approach was more in the end of the 15th century, the reign of Henry VII, and then the early reign of Henry VIII, really. But I'm learning so much from you from a time period. I'm so interested because I am moving on into Mary I and all that time. So I just think it's great. It's like perfect combination, right?
I think so it is.
Thank you for inviting me back.
Oh, it's just always so much fun to have you back. I'm sure there are other people who want to be on the show, but... I just want Emma all the time. No offense to anybody else, but
I can interrupt more than one person, so you can invite another. That's my goal today, is I'm not going to interrupt Rebecca. That's my goal. I'm going to try really hard.
We'll see how this turns out. Okay, so today what do you want to talk about today?
So, you know, because of all those lovely comments that I was, and it seemed to me like there was people who wanted more on the daughters of Isabel, they are really coming out of the dark now. There's a lot of work being done on them. So shout out to all those researchers in Spain, mainly. There's other places too, because, for example, Juana goes into Flanders, so there's other researchers involved. But in Spain, people are doing a great job now. Especially in our research group, Arte, Poder y Género, we have focused on them for a long time. So, for example, my coworker Melania Soler Moratón, she did her PhD on the devotion of these four women. And then, for example, my good friend Ruth Martinez Alcorlo published the first biography of the eldest, so Isabel, named like her mother. This was published in Spanish by Silex in 2021. So, I mean, there's a lot of work being done on them. And I think people want more, because in those comments that I was reading the other day, it seemed like they're very unknown, but people like them. Don't you think?
I think so, too. We know so much about Catherine, and we know so much about Juana. But these other sisters do seem to have been left in the shadows because we maybe don't have such a strong connection to the Tudor court. Could that be why?
I think one of the main reasons, obviously, Catherine Aragon is famous because she becomes so relevant in the Tudor court, and that's, she's always going to be famous in England and for anyone who is interested in the Tudors. In the case of Juana, she does become this, she becomes queen, reina propietaria, so queen regnant, more or less the equivalent, and she has this tragic life. So I think she's just a mythical kind of historical figure, really. So a lot of people know her because of not because she was a ruling queen, for other reasons, right? But these two other sisters are unknown, I think, abroad. I think Maria is really the one that nobody really knows a lot about, despite the fact that she was very important, and we can talk about that. But then Isabel, the eldest, she is a somewhat well-known figure in Spain because she's very important for all the alliances that the Isabel and Fernando forge, especially with the Kingdom of Portugal. And that, we've talked about this, but I'll just refresh it for anyone who hasn't listened to the other episodes. in the late Middle Ages in the Iberian Peninsula, the monarchs like Isabel and Fernando had the idea that the Iberian Peninsula could be unified under one monarch. So their first goal was always to establish an alliance with Portugal because they had had problems with them too. So these are kingdoms. It sounds a bit like the the development of everything in England too in the 15th, late 15th century. It's because it's happening at the same time. Yes, it's so Isabel is important in Spain. She's now with this biography obviously starting to get her place more. But we still there's still many things people don't know about them.
Honestly, when it comes to those two, I really all I know is they shared a husband, and not in that sense. Like that, maybe that was kind of weird to say that. Not at the
You
same
know,
time.
with the Trastámaras and the Habsburgs and marriages, nothing surprises me anymore. So, and when you said it, I was like, I guess you're right. They did share a husband, not the same time. This is not the Tudor court. But yes, successively because this alliance was so important. So it sounds weird, but it's not weird when you understand the development of the historical development of the monarchies in the Iberian Peninsula. Let's begin by saying something that we said before too. Isabel and Fernando were cousins. So,
What?
what? Yes, they were cousins. And also, Isabel's mother was Portuguese. And she had been brought up in Arevalo with a Portuguese court, not in the court of Henry IV of Castile. Oh, we're starting to get the complexity of the names here. So I want to try and make it easier today than just give a ton of tons of names. So the important thing to remember is that for Isabel, Portugal was always key because she had had a big conflict. She had to fight for her throne. And Portugal had helped the other candidate, Juana de Castilla, the so-called Juana la Beltraneja. Juana la Beltraneja was the legitimate or illegitimate daughter of Henry IV of Castile, and a civil war broke out when he died because Isabel said, "No, you're not legitimate, so I'm the queen." So that alliance with Portugal was always crucial because Portugal had helped this other candidate, and she lived. She lived for many years. She was imprisoned in a
What?
convent.
I should
Yes.
be surprised. It seems like there's a pattern there.
I can understand that the fascination with Trastámaras and Habsburgs, that you've got poison, you've got cousins that marry, you have imprisonments. It's great. It's great. We should maybe write a TV show or something,
I was just going to
the
say, yeah, it
Trastámara.
sounds even better than the Tudors, all the drama that happened in the Tudors dynasty, that it's just as much over there.
Well, I don't know. The Tudors are pretty intense.
Okay, we don't. Was there a Spanish king who beheaded two of his wives?
No.
There
The
you
short answer is no. The long answer is no. No, but for example, something really cruel that happened to one of the daughters of Isabel is that Ferdinand of Aragon imprisoned his own daughter, Juana. So, you know,
Right.
that's intense if you think about it. And he didn't let her rule. So, I mean, he wasn't. I mean, there's still very dramatic things that happen in this court. For example, forcing his, and this is Isabella too, forcing their children to marry. For example, in the case of Isabel, the eldest, she was betrothed to the heir of the Portuguese crown for forever. And then when they marry in 1490, he dies like 5 months later. So she's a widow, and she comes back to Castile, and she doesn't want to marry. She wants to become a nun. And I was talking to, I'm lucky enough that I am friends with Dr. Ruth Martinez Alcoro, who wrote her biography. So this again, I take from people. This is not my work. But Ruth Martinez, I asked her, I was like, I'm preparing for this podcast. Can you give me some hints about what things Isabel is relevant for? And she was telling me that she is crucial because for a long time, she takes back her power because she doesn't want to marry again. And she's like, no, I want to be a nun. Because think about it, maybe now we think being a nun is something that is not something we associate with freedom. But in the 16th century, in the end of the 15th century, for a woman, it was. Because in Spain, Well, they had properties. Women had properties and they had titles and things like that. But also, they could use their money. If you had a husband, then it's your husband who's managing your money. And so, Isabel, for many years, she's like, I don't want to marry again. I want to become a nun. But her parents are like, we don't care. You're the eldest and you have to do this. And finally, she has to go on and marry. So, they marry things like, when you say the two sisters marry the same guy, they didn't have a choice. Because Isabel then goes on and marries this king of Portugal. She's pregnant and then she dies after having the baby. The baby dies 2 years after, so her sister has to go in and fill her in her shoes because the alliance with Portugal is too important. So these women, really, if you think about it, they didn't have much choice. And in the way that their parents, it sounds like, oh, their parents were awful. They didn't have a choice either because the Civil War could have been very could have had a very bad end for this family. So it's just a matter of survival, really, and of realizing that the times are changing. We're at the end of the Middle Ages and the beginning of the modern state, and things are changing very, very quickly. So they are in a pivotal time, really, too. So that's why they're so interesting to study.
Yeah. So you mentioned that Maria was important. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? What was her importance in all of this?
Well, let's place her, right? So let's just do a very quick refresh of the children of the Catholic monarch. So there's Isabel the Elder. She's born in 1470. We're talking about, it was still in the 15th century. And for another 8 years, she's the only one. So she becomes princess, not infanta. We talked about this, that she was princess of Asturias because she was the firstborn. Her next, the sisters that followed were infantas because they were not the firstborn. And the moment that her brother is born, she's not the heir anymore because he becomes the heir. He's Juan. So, but he's 8 years younger than her. So for a long time, while that war is still raging, Isabella has a little baby girl. So she has a very tough life. And she's sent to the Portuguese court to become basically hostage, for this marriage because she's the guarantee that the peace is going to be kept. So basically, that's what you get when you're firstborn girl. Then there's Juan, the heir, and of course we have to remember that he's the only boy. So he is raised in very carefully, but also there's a lot of angst because if something happens to him, what are you going to do? The following year, and I think this is remarkable about Isabella of Castile. The following year, she has three other kids, like in 5 6 years. So I think once she had the boy, she relaxed in a way. The war had ended, and that's how it works, sometimes. So she has these three girls in succession, and that allows Juana, we've talked about her, Maria, who we will concentrate on now, and then Catalina, Catherine of Aragon. And the thing is that when Maria is born, really, or Catherine, especially when Maria is born, she is not born at a time where another prince is born, like Arthur, for example, like Catherine, because Catherine becomes relevant for the Tudors right away. She's not even the first daughter or the second daughter, so she just becomes a daughter of the king and queen, and basically the one who's like waiting to see what happens with the rest, right? So that's why when her sister dies, she goes on to marry the king of Portugal. But she's very important because when she goes to Portugal, in her case, she has 10 children.
Wow.
Yeah. She has 10 children with Manuel the first. So, and her children, because Manuel and Maria were developing this renaissance in their court, and Manuel is very known for this. Even the architecture is named after him, the El Estilo de Manuelista, no? Manuelino, I think it's called. In architecture and things like that, he was very important. His children were educated with all the advantages that had been developed in the Portuguese court, and Maria, who comes from the court of Isabel and Fernando. So these 10 children become exceptionally important in the history of Europe, really. And we've talked about one of them, Empress Isabella of Portugal, right?
Right.
So anyone who wants to hear about her, we talked about how remarkable she was. So Maria becomes very important In the same way, her sister Juana becomes very important because they have many children, and those children go on to be kings, queens, and emperors. So that is part of their success. But she pays a high price because she dies after one of these, she has one of these babies. So in some cases, they have difficulties to have children. In other cases, they just die from it, even after having 10 children. Imagine that.
Right. That's the crazy part is that she made it that many births. And who knows, did she have miscarriages in there too? That's possible.
I'm sure it was. I don't think she had a lot of time to have miscarriages in this case. I think with the Trastámara women, we see very well the ones that didn't have so many problems had many children, and the ones like Catherine that did had many pregnancies, but not many children.
Almost
And
like
in the,
it might have been something wrong with maybe Henry the Eighth.
guess what? I think you might be right. And I think, I mean, it's totally, it makes total sense to me that there was something wrong with him. I mean, I know, and people have this different study that have been even done to, but yes, it seems like it was him because he had trouble with his other wife. So, I mean, and he had a couple sons, and they both die when they're teenagers, right? So, yeah. It was probably, and it was probably both. It's just 16th century is a brutal time. Each pregnancy is a risk. Each birth is a risk. Infection, they didn't have anything for those kind of things. I mean, Jane Seymour, there's so many women. There's so many women that die from these issues. That's why women don't get to be old in the 16th century. You know, the men die in war, the women die giving birth. Oh, tragic.
I thought for sure you were going to say something about Catherine Parr in there too, but it's fine. Not today, I guess.
Oh, you can talk like you can. Yeah, I'm sure you've got some bombs there. Come on, Rebecca. Tell us.
No. This isn't interviewing me day. We'll turn this back to your topic.
Okay. But yes, yeah, so Maria, in that sense, has that power that she does give 10 possible successors to the Portuguese court. And then, because as we know, the Trastámaras like to marry the cousins and all that. If you give a lot of children, then you have a lot of power to negotiate with those other courts. Think about it. And now we're in the Portuguese court, not in Spain. So Maria and Manuel, when they have 10 children, the Spanish court, all the relations with they had a relation with England too. So for example, Flanders. I mean, it's a power really to have a lot of children when you are a royal couple, and it's a mark of success. So Maria, in that sense, is very successful. But because she dies after childbirth, she doesn't live a long life. Like, for example, her sister Juana does. Juana is the one that lives the longest. Juana doesn't die until 1555.
Whoa, I think you tell me this every time we talk about her, and it surprises me every time.
Yeah.
15. Okay, so Mary was on the throne.
Yep.
So she got to see her niece become queen regnant.
She had news that the people would visit her. Let me check that it was 1555 or I think she, because her son, I mean, all the time that her son is ruling, she's the queen. She's the one that appears in the documents. So she's there with Charles V.
Yeah,
He's ruling really in her name, if you think about it.
so she would have known about Lady Jane Grey and what was happening there. And then it makes me wonder if she did anything to help Mary regain her throne or claim her throne.
I know that she was very old at that time. She did die in 1555. I know
Okay.
her health declined a lot in the last few years, so I don't know how aware she would have been or how able. I know that the first years that she was in prison, she did have a lot of contact with other, like her sister Catherine. And we've talked about this before. Catherine tried to bring Juana to England to marry Henry VII. And remember that Juana had been in the Tudor court for over a month with her husband Philip, before he died under very mysterious circumstances in Burgos. We talked about that too. So there was a lot of contact between the sisters early on, And then I think in the last years of Juana, her health was too bad, probably, to and her someone who's in prison for that long doesn't do well, you know? So
Yeah.
she wasn't doing well at the end of her life, of course not.
I always wonder how lonely she was.
Well, these people are imprisoned with spies. Juana, in the case of Juana, she's abused, physically abused by people who are taking care of her. This is not, I don't think people had the the bandwidth to think about mental health in the terms we think about it nowadays. So they had full authority to do whatever it took to make them comply. And Juana did have a very, she didn't accept very well things she didn't like, as is, you know, very normal for someone. It's just, it's not her fault, really. But on the other hand, these people that were with her also had orders to do whatever they needed. So this is a time where people's mental health is not considered. And she was think about it, she's a very important, despite the fact that she is imprisoned, she's still a threat. In 1520, just when Charles V was king of Spain, but he had never been to Spain. So when Ferdinand of Aragon dies and Charles V becomes the heir and the new king of Spain, he has to visit Spain because he's never been there. He doesn't even speak Spanish. So there's a revolt against him. And these people go to see Juana in Tordesillas, where she's imprisoned, to ask her, "No, you're the queen. We want you to be the queen. And this has to stop, this madness of this foreigner." Because one of the sons of Juana had been raised in Spain. In one of her trips, she had a son called Ferdinand, like his grandfather, and he had stayed there. So people said, either you, or there was another faction that were in favor of the Infante Fernando. So what Charles does, he sends his brother to, I think it's Austria. So he's like, "You can go and do your thing over there and serve me there." And then in the case of Juana, he's very lucky because she does not cave. Just, she's what, I'll listen to you. What are your concerns? I'm the queen. So she's exercising there her queenly status of listening to concerns, right? But at the same time, she says, "I will not sign anything to put my son's inheritance under, you know, under threat or under." So really, this has been an argument to say that she wasn't really mad, and that she was just cast away because she had a personality that wasn't fit for the women at the time, right? Because she wouldn't shut up when something was unfair. So this is why I like Juana so much, you know?
I
Because who
think
can relate to that?
she's so underrated.
So
And
much.
I hate to make this comparison, but I do see some similarities to Anne Boleyn and her imprisonment and her voice and what happened to her.
Exactly. And 100%. And this tells you, it's very telling of how your personality can really play against you especially when you're a woman. Especially when you're a woman, and this is in all the treaties of the time, educational treaties, and the treaties of Juan Luis Vives that he wrote for Mary Tudor. And it's women have to be virtuous, so they have to be prudent, so they have to be. Basically, you had to be a very good player, and you had to have a lot of self-control and self-restraint, because the king would humiliate you in public often. Henry VIII humiliated Catherine of Aragon many times in public. It was her reaction to it that, when it doesn't go down in history, it's because she just exercised that restraint and said, "Okay, I'll talk to him in private." Other times she did express her, I mean, for example, when he wanted to go to the Field of Cloth of Gold to meet with Francis I of France, all the ambassadors are like, "The queen." I mean, they were surprised because she's like, "No, I don't see this happening, Henry. Sorry, no." And then when he grows that beard, you remember he grows a beard and he says to she the ambassadors are like, "The queen doesn't like it. He's gonna shave it off," because the queen is like, "No. No, thank you. I don't like that beard." So there's times when they do affirm their power too. And in the case, I think, What it shows very well is in these cases, and let's talk about Anne Boleyn, is the favor you have from the king. So during the time that she has favor with the king, she can say many things and she can do many things that then when she loses favor, she cannot. I always remember that instance after the death of Catherine, because Catherine of Aragon dies, then Anne Boleyn has a miscarriage on Catherine of Aragon's funeral day, right? We
Right.
all know that. And after that, everything goes south between Anne and Henry. And
Right.
what does Henry say to Anne when she's raising concerns about what's happening and you're casting me away and this and that? What does Henry say to her? Shut up. Know your place, woman.
Yeah.
So it's all got to do with the favor of the king. And Catherine, for example, knew fine well what kind of person Henry was. So I think she exercised her influence on him behind the scenes more than she did. And unless, he's like, well, now we're not married. And she's like, wait a second. Wait a second. Let me pull on my Spanish robes and put on a show here at
Yeah.
Blackfriars. And I mean, Shakespeare wrote about it because it was so iconic. Just show up there and just kneel in front of him. And she had done this same tactic other times. For example, I want to say it's 1518, Evil May Day, when that conflict between the English artisans and the foreign artisans arose, and there was murders in London and a lot of unrest. And Henry sends orders to like capture all these people, and they're gonna be he's like, everyone's gonna chop off their heads, because it's Henry VIII. And it's Catherine, and I think it's Margaret Tudor is there too, and Mary Rose, and the three queens appear in public and kneel before the king to ask for pardon them. It that's that the queen had to be someone that behaved really well so she could exercise her power and her influence when she needed to, like in that sense. And Henry does pardon them. It's been said, well, it was orchestrated. Yes, but you still had to have a favor of the king for this to be able to happen, right?
Right, yes.
I just think that one of the things that Anne Boleyn didn't know how to do was play a role. Sometimes you had to play the role of just being just like they say in Ireland, keep your clogger shut, and just leave it for later, or have another tactic. So, yeah, in that sense.
It makes me wonder if it has more to do with the upbringing between Catherine of Aragon and Anne Boleyn. Clearly, Catherine of Aragon had a much more regal, royal upbringing. She knew how to behave. She was taught these things, whereas Anne Boleyn maybe was more of a witness to it. I guess I don't know how else to describe that.
Exactly. Remember that Catherine of Aragon was betrothed to Arthur Tudor in a very public ceremony at 3 years old in Medina del Campo. And she's already there sitting on her mother's lap, resting on her hip. She's there. And when Columbus comes back and all the shenanigans that happens in Barcelona and all these the momentous historical things that are happening in the reign of her parents, and she's there for all these ceremonies and for them to become the most powerful king and queen in Europe. And she's seen her mother act on all the time on this for years and years, for 16 years until she goes to England. Also, I think we have to not judge people by what they learn, but also the way they learn things. So I think Catherine took that as, well, I'm not going to be a queen regnant, but I'm going to be a queen consort. So she adapted those things in England too. And then she had a very pleasant personality. I think she truly didn't enjoy confrontation. She wasn't, all the ambassadors describe her as someone who always had a smile on her face. But I think, on the other hand, she always knew her place and what was her duty. And duty came first, came even before motherhood for Catherine of Aragon, duty. So it's a balance between your personality and what you have seen. I think in the case of Anne Boleyn, we have to remember that she's not royalty. She's not raised in a royal court. She's not raised with tutors like Alessandro Gherardini, who is a leading humanist in Europe. She's not raised like this. So the time where she gets its experience is when Catherine of Aragon sends her to Margaret of Austria, her friend. This is the time where she becomes fashionable. This is the time when she learns how to be a European lady, really, because I think the fascination with Anne Boleyn when she comes back is she's a European lady. She's not just an English lady anymore. And I think what Anne Boleyn did have was that she was very good at capturing those things too. She was smart, very smart. And using that in your advantage is amazing. So despite the fact that she wasn't raised as royalty, we have to give her her place because she did something amazing. I mean, she turned the monarchy around, didn't she?
You could say
And
that.
then she had to have a lot of also like she had to be brave because Catherine of Aragon was a very loved queen in England. Not by Henry, obviously, at the end, but her subjects loved her. There was people booing her Anne Boleyn in her coronation. It wasn't a popular. There's this fascination about Anne Boleyn now, but she wasn't liked in England at the time by the majority of the people. The majority of the people thought that what she was doing to Catherine of Aragon was very unfair, and because it's a rupture. Now we see it as, well, people are entitled to be happy in these things. Not at that time, and not with a king who, and this is also a problem, Henry VIII's reign is starting to decline in this time, too. That's my perspective on it. So this is the beginning of a decline, and I think people think because he ended up with this woman, it's never the king's fault, right? It's always put
Right.
on the women, too, which is very unfair. But it is the way that it goes. The king is the king, and he's never going to
Yeah.
be at fault. Catherine of Aragon never once said it was Henry VIII's fault. She always said it was his advisors, bad advisors, things like that, but never once blamed Henry.
Do you think she really loved him?
Yes. I truly think she really loved him. I don't think that she understood love like we do. I think that she knew that, and again, I talk about this all the time, providence. God had chosen her to be Queen of England, and that was the King of England that she had to marry. Yes, she had to love him because that was, she had to love him because God had told her to love him. And when
Yeah.
I say we don't understand, we shouldn't understand her motherhood like we understand it now, she loved God above her daughter too. So, I mean, it's a different, totally different way of understanding love than we do. It's not in a romantic sense, more in this is my duty, and I love doing my duty because it's for my salvation, which is the end goal of life, really.
Yeah. You know, I'm gonna have to bring it. I have to bring it up
That
now,
was
Emma.
deep. That was
Well, you and I had a discussion last night, a private discussion. I think it was last night. Maybe it was the night before. Anyway, you just brought up some things from that. Now I'm gonna have to talk about it
Okay.
because the universal question is always, did they or didn't they between Arthur and Catherine? And
Oh.
I think I have made it clear what my stance on it was, but I have to admit, after talking to you the other night, I'm starting to lean more in the other direction because of how pious she was. So obviously, for those who don't know, my belief has been for a very long time, because I was raised Catholic, is that she could have lied and then just gone to confession and done her penance and all was well,
Yeah.
right? But Emma, you kind of added something to it that maybe I hadn't considered. So why don't you tell me again?
Well, first of all, I was raised Catholic too, so I know what you mean. but I'm afraid you're wrong, Rebecca. I don't think they did it. And there's many reasons why. First of all, one of the things that I like to think about in this sense is believing someone who never changes a story. And Catherine, since day one, said they hadn't done it. She did admit, and this is for someone who's basically saying they didn't do it, she did admit they slept together in the same bed for 7 nights, different nights. But I think what happened is they did sleep together, but nothing happened. That's what she said. And to me, for someone who, two people who were so young, so inexperienced, makes total sense to me. They weren't in a rush either. They weren't rushing them. The fact that they did a public bedding and all that, that is a ceremonial. But these young people were expected to get to know each other. I mean, they weren't totally, they were expected to grow to like each other, to these happen a bit more organically. That's why Catherine wasn't sent until she was basically almost a woman. Let's see, it's a bit cruel to say because she was very young. But you know what I mean, until she was able to understand where things should go in a marriage, right? Let's just leave it at that. Let's leave it at that. But in the case of Arthur, we have to think that also the boys were raised in a way that it was, what experience did he have? Zero. And then the first night he's ready to go. You know, I just, that was my first suspicion always, is like, you know, they're too young, really, to understand and zero experience. It's not like today where everybody's learning things from the internet, from school, from this, from that.
Right.
That's the first thing I think is very important to know. And then the fact that she always denied it, and the fact that when Alexandro Giraldini said that he did think that they had consummated, she shunned him for the rest of his life.
Wow.
And he was sent back to Spain. And her dueña was outraged that he would have said that, because she said, I assure you that this has not happened. Mm-hmm. And this was a great offense to say to a Spanish infanta, who above all had to be honest and chaste.
Yes. Okay. So the other part of my argument that I want you to touch on too, is that not only did I think she could confess and do penance, but mm-hmm. that she would also do anything to keep her daughter in the line of succession or keep her daughter protected. What's your argument against that?
No, I don't think she would have done something against her conscience and against her salvation and against God. And she said that many times that she wouldn't. So one of the things that she says when Wolsey comes in is like, well, you're not queen anymore and this and that. And then she gets this document where she's not addressed as queen anymore that she has to sign. And she asks for a quill and she crosses out every reference to princess and writes queen on them. And she, for all the restraint that she had, she says, and I talked about a paper that I did in the Renaissance Society of America about this. She says, I cannot admit to have been the harlot of the king for 24 years. She cannot, it's not possible to admit what is not, hasn't happened. And this is an insult to me. So I don't think she would have done it to keep Mary. I think she was doing it for herself. She was like, you calling me a liar? And you know, and then I think the other argument, and she went to the Blackfriars trial. And the first thing that she said to Henry was, when she was kneeling, you know, I came and made to you. And you know why she said that? Because when for Empress Isabella of Portugal sent to find out about, you know, the witnesses that were gathered, all those people that were with Catherine when she had been married to Arthur, they found her chamberwoman, Catalina de Motril. And she declared, and this is a bit, you know, but she declared that the morning after Henry and Catherine had slept together for the first time, there was blood in the sheets. The king never doubted that she was a virgin when he married her. She was paraded in London as a virgin. So Henry then thought, changed his mind 25 years down the line, and finds these guys to say things like, I was in the midst of Spain. Really?
Right.
Are we going to believe that story? Are we really not going to see through that and pass that? I don't think she was lying about that. I think it would have taken so much to lie about that when, I mean, maybe I could, because I don't have that idea about my ultimate goal in life is to, you know, favor God. But Catherine did believe her salvation was the most important. Even more important than being Queen of England was being chaste and honest and not lying about the things she said to God. And she swore on God many times that she had not had sex with Arthur. They had slept together.
Yeah.
They had not had sex. I believe it.
I think that's the most compelling argument to me that you make, is how chaste she was and what her salvation meant to her. That clicks in my head a little bit more, because I think I keep forgetting that it wasn't just once that she was asked, you know, oh, she was just asked once and she said, oh, no, or, you know, it was several times, which then gives it a whole different weight.
She was asked the second it happened, the second he died, she was asked. She was asked, and remember that she was very sick when Arthur died. So it probably had the same illness, right? And it's Elizabeth of York, the queen, who sends for a letter because Queen Isabel just goes crazy. She's like, get her out of there. Why is she still there? You know, because they're very concerned she's going to die. So they take her back to London, and that's the first thing they ask her. Her mom asks her that privately in the reports. They could, you know, and all the reports say that she's a virgin. All the reports say that she's a virgin. And the only person in her household that says that he thinks it's been consummated is Alessandro Gherardini. And he's out of the picture unless that you can say Gherardini. I mean, he's out. He's out. And he even goes on to go to America, and he even sends gifts to her. And like, I'm sorry. And she's like, no. Because truly, this was how important it was to her. Her honesty was the most important thing, because it was her honesty to God, not to Henry, not to her mother. That's why I don't think she would have lied over and over and over. And she never changed the story. That's a very typical thing of someone who's saying the truth.
Right.
And she did admit to sleeping with him, which for a very chaste Catholic woman, that was a lot to admit. That could have had implications for her, admitting that she had slept with him, because people could have said 7 nights, nothing happened. I truly believe nothing happened.
You know what, Emma, Dr. Emma, I think you've changed my mind.
Oh, well, and you know, the thing about it, we'll never know. But the most likely explanation is that she was not lying, that nothing happened, because they probably didn't know what to do very well. And what if it happened eventually? Of course.
Right.
Would she have had children with Arthur if he had lived? Of course. But it's just, she was saying the truth. I only had 6 nights with him. What do you want me to do?
I feel like in my head, it makes more sense when I compare Catherine to Thomas More. I mean, he would not go against his conscience, right? And so it was similar for her in that respect. And he died to hold on to what was in his conscience.
And think, that's a very good comparative, because it's true. And these people were obsessed with their salvation. They were scared. I mean, think about, and not only the Catholics, think of Luther and all the things he says, but, you know, they were truly scared of the wrath of God. So we have to understand that for her to lie over and over, and let's think of the other side. Has Henry VIII ever been known to lie? Come on. He's the biggest liar in the history of mankind. Come on.
Well, I don't know about that, but close.
It's just, sometimes I think, why is there a debate over this? But it's so obvious to me, especially when you read those reports of the servants of Arthur. And he was like, I mean, Arthur Tudor was not a 6'4", 25-year-old, you know, robust. No. He died like, by the way, when they were married, she was a tiny woman, Catherine of Aragon. He's described even shorter than her and smaller than her. I think he just had a problem, honestly.
Well,
his portrait, he doesn't look very, very developed in his portrait, you know, and the only portrait of him painted at Vivum, and we can talk more about what at Vivum represents, means that it was painted during his life. It's in Hever Castle. In that portrait, look at him. He looks like a boy. He doesn't look like someone who's ready for marriage and children, does he?
No.
And this is painted, you know, probably right before he dies.
Yeah. The best way for me to describe it is he looks delicate.
Yes, exactly. And like Juan, you know, and so Catherine's sister did marry Margaret of Austria, and they did do the deed, because Margaret is pregnant when he dies. So, I mean, sometimes it did happen. Sometimes, like in the case of Catherine of Aragon, I think it didn't. I think that they were both willing for it to happen. They got married with all the consequences. Just the way things developed, it just didn't work very well.
Mm. Okay, I have a what if question for you, because sometimes these are a little bit fun. What if Henry VIII had not met Anne Boleyn and just stayed with Catherine? What would the outcome, do you think, have been?
He would have met someone else. I don't think Anne Boleyn was someone special for him. It was Charles V marries Elizabeth, Isabella of Portugal, breaking his commitment to Mary Tudor, and that's when Henry decides he's done with Catherine of Aragon. And I think he, if it wasn't Anne Boleyn, and that he shows that because then he loves Anne Boleyn, but 5 minutes later he loves someone else. So I think he would just would have found he just needed a young woman to give him a son. What we all know he was obsessed with, having a son.
Right, which makes
So
sense.
yeah, it makes sense. Of course it makes sense. There had never been a woman in the throne of England. Probably Catherine was telling him every day, but my mother, he's like, this is not Spain, Catherine, come on. I get his side too. I mean, I'm not totally against what Henry was trying to do because I get it. It's difficult. The Tudors, his dad arrived to the throne in very suspicious circumstances and, well, winning in battle and all that. So they weren't that assured in the throne. It's just that he should have been able to see that in Europe, what was happening at the time is like some women had to rule because it was just too difficult and too complex for these very weak lines like his, because his sons just keep dying, to perpetuate. I mean, remember that Catherine and Henry had a boy in
Yeah.
1511, Henry. So it's I think he was just like, this woman has not given me what I want. She's so I'm just gonna move on to someone else. I
Yeah.
don't think Anne Boleyn, I think Anne Boleyn was circumstantial. I don't think that she was special to him, to be honest.
You know, I wonder, had Henry Fitzroy lived, if he would have
Yes.
been named an heir. And I suspect, I'm just going to throw this out there.
Yeah.
I don't have a whole lot of evidence on it, but I suspect Henry Fitzroy may have been poisoned as well.
Okay, when are we doing the poison episode?
Well, we're really adding to the list here, aren't
Yeah.
we? We got quite a few.
Yeah, and Henry Fitzroy, he does, I mean, this does upset a lot Catherine. And when he gets he's becoming a duke and this and that because it is a threat. And it's always a threat when a king that only has a daughter has a bastard son, right? This is what Game of Thrones is based on, the Tudors and the Trastámaras and all this. So it is a threat. Catherine gets really upset when he gets favored. And she doesn't get upset for other things that should upset her. So yeah, I mean, there was many interests there for that boy not to continue too. So
I mean,
yeah.
we had both Mary and Elizabeth alive at the same time as Henry Fitzroy.
Exactly.
So who, you know, we have the Catholics and maybe those on Anne Boleyn's side who were more reformers, quietly, maybe back then a little bit more, whose interest was to put their relative on the throne next. So
Exactly. And I think it's also foreign influence versus English interests too. We have to think that foreign influence in England is always taken suspiciously by many of the members of the gentry and nobility. So these are interests that are go further than religion. And because religion at this point is just such a mess too. So the Catholic religion too is just transforming too, but I think it goes deeper than that. I think there's a lot of court interests, and when the people start to see that Catherine's influence over Henry is declining, because first Wolsey is coming to power, and then all the influence that Wolsey has on Henry and on the French alliance, right? But
Yeah.
then after that, in when Catherine clearly is becoming out of the picture. Everybody wants to have Henry's favor too, because someone has to be the next one. And you know, if we can kick out these Spaniards, then maybe we can get in and have a piece of the cake, you know?
Yeah.
So that's I think it's got to do a lot with that too. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I, you know, the other thing I find interesting about all of this is you mentioned the betrothal between Mary and Charles V. and the big age difference between the two. It makes me want to scratch my head a little bit and go, what was Henry thinking? Like, how upset could he really be that Charles broke it and married somebody closer in age to him so that he could have heirs?
Exactly. But if we look back at Henry's personality, he would just behave like this when he didn't get his way. He threw a huge tantrum when Ferdinand of Aragon, in the 1510s, when they both went to war together, and Ferdinand negotiated the peace with France without letting him know. Actually, the report is sent to Catherine's council, and it's Catherine who protests against her dad, and she says, "You can't treat the King of England like a boy. He's not a boy anymore." Well, he clearly he was, because his wife was arranging his things for him. But it just happens, and he can't take the fact that Charles is more powerful than him, and he can actually do this and say, like, "Well, I don't need you right now, so it was great, but you know." So it's just, whenever you humiliated Henry in his view, he would just have a fit and do something extreme. So this, to me, is just not surprising that he did all of this. It's just, he was like, "I'm fed up with these Habsburgs that, smile one day, and then the next day they're like, 'Sorry, you're not important enough,' you know?" And to tell Henry VIII he wasn't important enough, imagine how it must have been that. Because we see him, I'm not sure I'm going to be very popular for saying this, but we see in England, people see him as this great big European figure. But breaking news, he's not that big in Europe. He tries to be emperor, he doesn't succeed. He tags along for, like, artistic innovation. Let's think about that, one of my fields of expertise. There's always someone else who is doing the job for him. It's either Catherine of Aragon, Wolsey. So, I mean, I think it's just because he marries six wives and he chops heads off and things like that, and because he has this huge break with Rome, he becomes very famous and popular. He's not that important or relevant, and he knew it, because the important and relevant people were Francis the First of France and Charles the Fifth, who were the ones battling in Italy, the territories between each other, who were, dominating more. Charles. Charles is the arguably the most powerful man in the Renaissance. So, Henry just couldn't take it, I think.
It bruised his ego, his very delicate ego.
Exactly. I mean, anyone who knows a little bit about Henry VIII, this is not a surprise, right? He just had a fragile ego, and he thought he was more than he really was. He wasn't that relevant in European history.
He wanted to
Oops,
be.
he wanted to be. He was a wannabe.
He was the kid that was like, look at me, I'm over here. Look what I can do. I can
Yeah.
marry
And they were
six
like,
wives.
"Yeah, great, great job." I think my favorite, so one of the other kings that I despise is Francis the First. Francis the First was horrible, especially to women. He was a horrible man to women. He was a great monarch, and he was an outstanding patron of the arts. He was able to bring Leonardo da Vinci to France. Imagine how important and relevant he is. But my favorite thing is when the Battle of the Egos, when Francis and Henry meet, and the Field of Cloth of Gold is just a battle of egos, and they can't help themselves, and they have a fight. If that is not telling you, well, those two people, men, were like, I don't know what will, because they just have a fight in front of everyone. And Francis wins, by the way. How Henry must have felt after that.
It's funny because I've just been rewatching The Tudors again. It's been quite a few years. And whenever I watch that show, sometimes it confuses the history I know. I'm like, wait, I saw that. No, that's not right. That wasn't true. But The Field of Cloth of Gold, I just watched recently, and that the scene where they're wrestling and Francis throws him down and how upset Henry is
Well,
says a lot.
let's talk about behind the scenes there. So they have a fight. Imagine how Henry felt humiliated. And then they go back to England, but they stop in Calais. They stop in Calais and they see Charles. They see Charles the Fifth, because
That's right.
he comes to make a point that if Henry wants to be his ally, And Henry, who is probably still bruised from his fight with Francis, that's when he starts negotiations to betroth Mary to. So Henry's basically like, I'm going to be Charles's friend now, you know, because
Right.
Henry, yes, because Fran. And this is when, this is a bomb today, okay? This
Ooh.
is when there's a woman, and this is a Venetian ambassador, who are the best people in the world because they give us all the gossip. He says that when they are in Calais, they do a big feast for Charles, and that there's a woman that gives Charles a portrait of himself, and then he gives her a chain, a very expensive chain. This is a woman artist, and Charles V is awarding her for this portrait. If it's a woman, she's in the queen's household. And this portrait, a portrait by one of the leading Flemish artists that introduced Renaissance portraiture into England, the Hohenbouts, we've talked about them again. We have a portrait of Charles V, a miniature portrait in the Victoria Albert Museum that must probably was that portrait that Susanna Hohenbaum gave to Charles in Calais. So imagine how smart Catherine was that after he has the fight with Francis, he's like, but look at my nephew. He's nice. Don't you think he's good for our Mary? Right?
Yes.
And we have another miniature, Hohenbaum miniature in the National Portrait Gallery in London, that it's Mary, and she's wearing a little brooch that says the Emperor in French. So these are probably the portraits that Susanna painted. So for Catherine to say, great, he had a fight with Francis, let's make this happen. In 1522, they reached the agreement. And that document that is now in the Archivo General de Simancas in Spain has an illuminated initial where Henry is there enthroned under a canopy made by a Tudor rose and a pomegranate. If that doesn't have
Oh.
Catherine of Aragon all over it, and Horan boots, and let's bring this amazing art to convince Henry and seal this deal and marry Mary to Charles, because the Horan boots had been working for Margaret of Austria and Charles V too. So this is Catherine is using art and portraiture to convince Henry after a huge fight with Francis.
It just goes to show how important those visual items were during this time.
And how smart women were, because Catherine said to Susanna, now is the time, do it, give him the portrait. Henry's still, you know, because they were still technically in France. I mean, Calais was English, but they were still in France. So, and this is just days after this fill of cloth of gold. But because the Spanish alliance hasn't been studied in depth before, these pieces of information are lost to us, and then we just get the big picture of Francis and Henry are these two big rivals, but Charles is always there, in and out. He's the only
Yeah.
emperor of the Holy Roman Empire who visits England twice,
Wow.
I think. Twice, yeah, twice.
That's impressive.
That's during the time that Catherine is his ambassadress. She's always so. Two things we have to remember is her other objective was to advance the alliance. She remained a Spaniard until her death. She says this. When she's in the Black Friars trial, she says, I'm a foreigner. I don't have friends here. And she realizes that once the favor of the king she's lost it, everybody's hostile really, because nobody wants to be allowed the one that, you know, is against the king,
Yeah.
really.
Yeah.
So
Oh.
she always fought for the interests of Charles. Going back to the idea of the daughters, Charles is the son of Juana of Castile. So Catherine, he calls Catherine and Henry my uncle and my aunt. So this is how close these, and this is how important these daughters of Isabella become in European history,
Yeah.
because the most powerful man in the 16th century was the son of one of them, Charles V.
Emma, seriously, we have covered so much information again
Yes.
today. I thank you for all of your knowledge again. I don't even know how to like title this episode because we
Yeah.
covered so much, but
I know.
I'll figure something out. But to end, I think I want to go back to my roots and something that I used to do with some of my previous guests. And I'm going to ask you if you could safely travel back in time to any one moment, let's say within in the history that you're comfortable with, What moment would you want to go back to and be an observer?
The moment I just described, 1520, Calais, Susanna Horenbout giving Charles V the portrait that she had painted. This is way before Sofonisba Nguissola and the other Levina Turnleg and the other women artists that we know about. I'm so proud to have made this discovery. It's amazing to think that these women were playing the highest of politics involving art and something as cool as portraiture, which is one of my favorite things, as you know. So if I could have been there, oh, maybe in that banquet too, you know, they probably had a good time, you
Right.
know, and seeing Henry all bruised. Oh my goodness. Yes, that's the moment I want to go back to.
Wonderful. Well, Emma, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you. Have a great day.